Chapter 4. Kontar Sector. Day 85 of the Midrim Retreat.
You have no idea how the Empire really works. The Rebel Alliance military transport Thunderstrike was not designed for comfort. Its corridors were lined with pipes and panels, and its doors were bulky and cumbersome, plated with heavy durasteel. Over the years, Twilight Company had stripped down and reconfigured the aging Corellian Corvette, partitioning and repartitioning the ship's few open spaces until barely a square meter was left unused. Thus, when Hal ordered the prisoner brought to his storage unit-turned-office for questioning, the meeting was an intimate one. On one side of Hal's flimsy folding desk sat the captain himself, flanked by Lieutenant Sargon and Chief Medic Von Geis. While Sargon stood stiff as ever, like an ancient and gnarled tree, Von Geis had propped himself atop an offline holoprojector. Facing Howl and leaning back in her chair, with exaggerated ease, was Governor Chalice, smiling like an empress. Behind Chalice stood Namir, who watched the governor's hands as if she might be about to reach across the desk and strangle the captain. "I'm not saying that to be insulting," Chalice went on. "But if you think Hadoral Prime was anything more than a backwater, you're operating under dearly mistaken assumptions. My appointment there was a punishment, not an elevation." She spoke in a low voice, full of bored confidence. In the safety of the ship, her Coruscanti accent, the accent of the Imperial elite, a propaganda broadcast and rebel satire, seemed overly enunciated to Namir's ears.
"And why did you deserve punishment?" the captain asked.
Chalice cocked her head as if surprised by the question. "When your rebellion started encroaching on the Mid-Rim, the Emperor set his dog loose. You heard about the deaths of Moff Coover and Minister Kempt?"
"Tragic accidents, as I recall," Hal said.
"According to my sources, both died at the hand of Darth Vader. Emperor Palpatine decided that incompetence at the highest ranks was to blame for the destruction of his Death Star, and from there began a culling. There were other deaths, less public," she added with a shrug. "I was spared out of acknowledgement for my past contributions, and because I had enough sense to limit my involvement with the battle station. Exile to Hadoral Prime was the best I could hope for, under the circumstances." Von Geis peered at Chalice as if inspecting the skin of her forehead.
"And that's when you chose to defect?"
he asked. Namir suspected Von Geis was present to put a kind face on the company. He'd begun the meeting by checking Chalice over, asking about after effects of the stun bolt, while Howl had waited patiently and Lieutenant Sargon had scowled. Von Geis was a smart man, and he knew the role he'd been asked to play. Kind, fatherly, sympathetic. But Chalice barely looked at anyone but the captain. "Don't be absurd," Chalice said. "Even on Hadoral, I had time to read, time to sculpt. I had money for occasional luxuries." She turned in her chair and reached down to where Namir had placed her duffel bag. He'd already inspected it for weapons, though he'd only delivered it to the office under protest. Unlike Von Geis, Namir wasn't in the room to ask questions or manipulate the governor. Hal hadn't said as much, of course, but Namir knew he was present as muscle. Chalice's capture was being kept a secret. As first sergeant, Namir was a high-ranking grunt, authorized to witness senior staff discussions and duty-bound not to do a thing about them.
"And speaking of luxuries," Chalice said, "you've been more than hospitable, and I've been ungracious."
From the bag, she retrieved a glass bottle filled with a translucent violet liquid adrift with gossamer white threads. She turned it in her hands, set it on the desk with a heavy thunk, then withdrew a handful of yellow fruit, which she placed beside the bottle. "A gift from Hadoral to my hosts.
local brandy and native figs. Something to celebrate our new relationship.
The lieutenant looked questioningly at Howell. Howell lifted one of the fruits and, with a smile, began peeling it as Chalice uncapped the bottle. Normally, when a recruit smuggles alcohol aboard, she knows better than to share it with the senior staff, Howell said, though his tone was light. Then you should vet them for better manners, Chalice replied.
Cups?
None were forthcoming, and with a shrug, she took a sip directly from the bottle. When she removed the brandy from her lips and slid it across the table to Howell, she tilted her head to look up at Namir.
Perfectly safe, she said.
The thought of poison had crossed Namir's mind. He cursed himself for being transparent enough to show it, and Chalice for seeing through him. The others passed the brandy bottle as Chalice started on the fruit, continuing to speak between bites.
So, as I said, an exile to Hadoral was far from the worst fate. Then you came to my planet, and I realized I was doomed.
Your mansion wasn't a target, the lieutenant said.
Chalice laughed bitterly.
Being shot by rebels wasn't my worry. Who do you think will be blamed for the failure of Hadoral's defenses? Who will be held responsible for the raid on her city, the theft of Imperial supplies? I could argue I worked miracles, holding your men off with a legion of stormtroopers spread across three continents. I could argue Hadoral was an obvious target months before I even arrived, and that I did all I could to shore up its defenses. But Darth Vader,
Chalice continued, her patter slowing, her eyes intent on Howell again after dancing about the room,
doesn't take to rational, reasoned arguments.
My reputation was already blemished. The moment your ship arrived in orbit, my life in the Empire ended.
Too bad you didn't ask to defect then, the lieutenant said. Would have saved us some trouble.
Namir choked back a laugh. Howell bit into his fruit and said nothing.
Some men delude themselves all their lives, Chayla said. I feel no shame in taking 24 hours to reconcile with reality. What's past is past. It's time we discussed our future together.
No one else spoke. Chayla seemed to take that as a cue to continue.
I offer my full cooperation to the Rebellion. In return, I expect to be rewarded for my bravery in turning against our terrible Imperial oppressors.
Von Geis finally cleared his throat, but Howell interrupted first.
We'll talk, he said. But so far we haven't even heard what you have to offer.
Something tightened in Namir's chest, not because the question was the wrong one to ask, but because he knew it was one Chalice had been waiting for.
I'm not a fleet admiral, she said, and leaned forward, shoulders low as if she were ready to pounce. I'm not here to share some weak point in the Star Destroyer's defenses. My knowledge is the Empire's lifeblood. Everything that courses through its veins, everything that nourishes it. Food, raw materials, manpower. I know why a slave revolt on Kashyyyk spells doom for outposts along the Cathal Rift, and why General Veers can't afford another Thorolite shortage along the Rimmer. I know the monster the Empire has grown into. I understand its biology. Every hyperlane carries oxygen to its limbs. I know where to pinch to make it sputter and suffocate.
Howell nodded and tapped his knuckles on the desk. You're a logistics expert. The lieutenant said quietly,
Before you were governor, you did what? Ran labor camps? Starved planets if they didn't meet their quotas?
Chalice was still staring at Howell and leaning in. She smiled at the question.
I was an advisor. I advised. My predecessor, Count Vidian, was the one who liked getting his hands dirty. I'm more interested in the big picture. Of course, none of that matters so long as you're on the run. The Rebellion needs to put some distance between its armadas and the Midrim, now that you've abandoned it, or you risk being overtaken. I've got suggestions for that, too. Then she moved. Namir couldn't stop her. If the office had been larger, if the desk hadn't been the flimsiest of barriers, Chalice couldn't have pulled herself forward and leaned in to put her head beside the captain's. The brandy bottle tipped to one side and fell to the floor. Chalice's lips moved as she whispered something outside Namir's hearing. Namir's hand was on her shoulder an instant later, dragging her back into the chair while she laughed. Howl appeared unfazed and certainly unharmed, eyes half-lidding in thought. Von Geis and the lieutenant looked on with bitterness and concern.
"I think," Howl said as Namir's fingertips dug into the governor's suit, "we should end here. We all have a lot to think about. I'll speak to you later, Governor."
Chayla smiled and bowed her head. If Namir's role in the meeting had been to protect the captain or the company, he felt profoundly certain he'd failed. After doling out the supplies stolen from Haydoral to the rest of the Rebel battle group, the Thunderstrike peeled off with the Dornian gunship Apylona's Promise. The Promise was a mean, compact dagger of a ship that had run with Twilight previously. Its crew of a few dozen Alliance Navy veterans collectively owed the soldiers of Twilight Company nearly 50,000 credits, according to a running tally on the door of the starboard barracks. The Promise also bore a pair of X-Wing starfighters on its undercarriage. Their pilots had earned a special infamy for never deigning to set foot aboard the Thunderstrike. Howl hadn't announced Twilight Company's new assignment since leaving Haydoral, and the bridge crew and senior officers were staying tight-lipped about the ship's destination. Neither was unusual, but where there was no hard information, rumors took the place of facts. The engineering crew studied the Thunderstrike's course and declared it en route to wild space, racing to escape Imperial territory by plunging headlong into the unknown. Veterans from the Chargona campaign murmured about a coming last stand against a blockade of Star Destroyers along the edge of the Mid-Rim. It was telling, Namir thought, that no one spread rumors of imminent victory. Still, wartime gossip was as good a distraction as any for bored soldiers crammed into a metal box with nothing to do but wait. The rumors wouldn't have bothered Namir if not for the presence of the new recruits. Trainees didn't focus well when they thought they were doomed. Twilight Company had picked up 28 volunteers on Haydoral Prime. It was a good haul, though a third of them weren't fighters. They'd serve as medics or engineers or crew for the Thunderstrike, and they weren't Namir's problem. The others needed to be put through their paces before being assigned to squads. As First Sergeant, Namir had that special pleasure.
"You all know how to use a blaster?"
he asked, after marching into the mess hall where he'd ordered the fresh meat to assemble. He had a fully charged rifle slung over his shoulder. The 19 remaining recruits sat around steel tables in the otherwise empty mess. The men and women looked at one another and nodded awkwardly in response to Namir's question.
"Good," Namir said. "I'm not here to mother you. Find a friend to take you to the weapons range. Learn how to use the DLT-20A. A rifle isn't a pistol. It's got more kick and it'll burn your face off if you hold it too close. The 20s have a couple extra modes, but I don't want you spraying bolts everywhere until you can hit a target."
As he spoke, he held up his rifle with one hand and swapped out the power pack with the other. It was a rote exercise, and he had to remind himself to slow down for his audience.
"You get a Twilight soldier to vouch for you, tell me you can handle the basics, that's all I need."
Again, the awkward nods. Namir strode to one of the occupied tables, set the rifle on the tabletop, and sent it spinning toward the recruits at the far end.
"That goes for more than just shooting, though.
If you can't find one of my guys who'll trust you with his life, I really don't care how good a sharpshooter you are or what your grades were at Dirt Rag Academy. You don't set foot on a planet until someone clears you. If you're too shy to partner up on your own, fine. Come to me. I'll assign you a buddy. He'd given variations on the same speech over a dozen times. At the start, he'd tried to train every recruit personally. It had been arrogant and stupid, the mark of a man who didn't yet trust the competency of Twilight's veterans, and he liked to think he knew better now. He paced across the mess floor, ensured he'd made eye contact with all the recruits, then flashed a half-smile. Also, you'll probably share a squad with whoever you con into saying you're ready. Try not to pick someone you want to strangle. Nervous laughter. That was good. They were paying attention. Or most of them were. At the corner of one table sat the red-haired girl Namir had seen fighting in the plaza on Hedoral. She was looking past him, staring at the wall, and her hands were vibrating against the tabletop. Namir stepped around her, slapped a hand on her shoulder, and felt her flinch, like she was ready to jump and throw a punch. That she wasn't stupid enough to do it counted for something. "What's your name?" he asked. The girl scooted in her seat until she could look up at Namir. "Roach," she said. Namir watched her. Her jaw was set. She no longer twitched. "That what you want to be called?" he asked. "Yes." Namir laughed louder than he'd intended. "More advice," he called as he glanced at the others. "If you've got friends back home you want to protect or you just feel like starting fresh, now's a good time to pick a new identity. No one in Twilight cares who you were, but once you make us learn a name, you better keep it." At least it wasn't another Leia. Half the fresh meat that joined up tried to call themselves after one rebel hero or another. They got relabeled by their comrades fast. Most of them died shortly after, victims of their own enthusiasm. He turned back to the kid. "Roach," he said, "tell me something. You read your field guide yet? The white book?" Roach stared up at him. "Yes, Sergeant," she said. Namir cocked his head. It wasn't the answer he'd been expecting. "So you can tell me about the four-phase training process?" Roach's teeth were chattering, but she didn't hesitate. "First two phases are same for everyone. Different phase three for ground and space forces. Phase four is special units." "And what does the white book say about recruits who can't pass training before deployment?" This made Roach pause. "They start again at phase one," she said. "Unless an officer says they can't?" It was a guess, not a statement. Namir let his amusement show. "I have no clue," he said. "Good for you, reading all that. But the bad news is you wasted your time. You all need to understand that the White Book, all those procedures and regulations High Command vomits at us, it's cooked up by generals who think they're running a government instead of a rebellion." He shrugged and retrieved his rifle, slinging it back over his shoulder. "Maybe Alliance Special Forces takes it seriously, I don't know. Out here, when someone above you gives an order, you follow it. When someone tries to teach you something, you pay attention. When someone shoots at you, you shoot back. Don't smuggle alcohol or spice aboard. Don't be stupid. And if you have a problem with another soldier, come to Lieutenant Saragon or me. We'll set things right. Short version, Twilight Company takes care of its own. So long as you remember that, you don't need regulations from on high." Namir saw the older recruits nod in understanding. The younger ones, the ones who still weren't sure about what they were giving up, looked less certain. Many of them had grown up in an empire that was nothing but rules and order. That was okay. They'd get there. He wrapped up the orientation briskly, listing which sections of the Thunderstrike were off limits and answering the usual questions about pay. "Stash what you've got under your bunk and pray the banking clan joins the Alliance. And comm network access. Put in a request, but don't get your hopes up." By the end, he'd memorized the names of about half the recruits.
If the others survived, he'd learn their names too. Namir was first out of the room. The others dispersed behind him, heading toward the assigned barracks or the weapons range. He noticed Roach tailing him, but he didn't turn to look back until she said, "Sergeant!" "What do you need?" he asked. Roach fell in at his side. Namir's boots hit the metal floor hard. The girl walked silently, and he saw she was still in foot wraps appropriate for Heydoro's flooded streets and not much else. He made a note to ask Hober about finding her something, anything more combat appropriate. "I lied," Roach said. Namir stopped, turned to Roach, and waited for her to elaborate. "I don't know how to use a blaster." Namir shook his head and tried not to smile. "2 hours," he said. "Meet me at the armory. We'll get you sorted." He didn't wait for an answer before he resumed his pace. He didn't expect a thank you. He'd voted Roach in on Heydoral. The least he could do was try to keep her alive. The Thunderstrike's makeshift brig was a secondary airlock along the ship's aft, plated with thick armor to repel boarders and fully controlled from the bridge. Its internal access panels had been welded shut. The exterior door remained functional. A prisoner could, in theory, be launched into space at the touch of a button, though Hal had made it clear that such a thing was never to be done. Namir had made it equally clear many months earlier in private to select crew that prisoners didn't need to know about Howell's squeamishness. Twilight Company's jail was naturally intimidating. Why give up that advantage? Namir doubted Governor Chalice was intimidated, but he could hope. No one but the captain and his closest advisors ever saw Chalice, who remained in her airlock 23 hours each day. Periodically, the governor met with Howell in private. Chief Medic Von Geis personally delivered Chalice's meals and brought her whatever she required for comfort, or at least whatever was available. In this way, Howell was able to keep the identity of Twilight's prisoner a secret from most of the company for a full 2 days. Namir didn't know how word got out, but he wasn't surprised or bothered when it did. The presence of a captive was too tantalizing a mystery to last for long, and it seemed a healthy distraction from constant speculation about the rebel flight from the mid-rim. Instead of wondering whether they'd survive to see planetfall again, soldiers debated what Chalice's presence meant. The recruits from Heydoral told stories of the governor's fickle tastes, how she would summon chefs and artists to her mansion, only to return them to the streets hours, days, or months later. The turncoats, those Twilight Company soldiers like Charmer, originally trained as Imperial cadets, who'd switch sides after being armed and set loose, recalled older rumors of a woman who whispered to the Emperor's viziers, whose true talent was in manipulating her foes and converting them into allies. The company's fascination with Chalice went too far only once, when one of the fresh meat, a squat, muscular young man named Corbo, who had a harsh red birthmark covering half his face, found his way to the airlock with a galley knife clenched in both hands. Corbo didn't resist when a passing technician urged him safely away, and Namir confronted him in private afterward. "Any special reason you wanted to see her?" Namir asked. "She killed my feelings," Corbo said. "I don't know what that is." Corbo shrugged. "Pat, doesn't matter. Governor thought too many were turning feral, making the city look bad." "That's the worst thing she did?" "No," Corbo said, "but it's what I can't forgive." They were both silent a while. "I wasn't going to do anything, I don't think," Corbo added. "I just wanted to see her." He balled and unballed his fists. "I'll leave the company if that's what you need." Namir sighed. "Can I trust you not to do it again?" he asked, expecting he knew the answer. "Don't be stupid," he thought. "Just lie to me." "I don't know," Corbo said. Namir swore inwardly. "If I post a guard," he said, "tell him to shoot you if you show your face near the brig again. Does that seem fair?"
That seems fair.
Good. Because I've got a lot of dead soldiers I need to replace. I need the lot of you in fighting shape, not abandoning ship. So as far as Namir was concerned, that resolved the incident. He made a point not to inform the captain. Others weren't as discreet.
I have no love of the Imperial Ruling Council.
Gadrin announced in regard to Corbo's aborted attack on Chalice.
And I am not alone. But a woman stripped of all power deserves pity and contempt, not fury.
Namir, Gadrin, and half a dozen others sat in the clubhouse, a cramped, dimly lit crawl space above the ship's engineering section that jumped with each pulse of the hyperdrive. Set amid metal pipes running from floor to ceiling were storage crates cushioned with throw rugs and a dented table someone had stolen from a bombed-out cantina. Namir was skimming through post-combat supply inventories that boiled down to not enough weapons, while Gadrin, Ajax, Brand, and Twitch played cards. Roach sat near the card players in Charmer's favorite spot, though Charmer was still in the medbay, observing. Namir didn't know how Roach had found her way to the clubhouse. It usually took recruits months to get an invite, and he certainly hadn't invited her.
She's got the captain's ear, Twitch muttered. Don't seem powerless to me.
Ajax ignored Twitch, eyeing Gadrin.
That mean you wouldn't take a swing at our prisoner if the chance came?
I shot her once already,
Gadrin said. Brand glowered until each of them drew from the deck. Roach had stopped watching the cards, instead staring down at her hands as she wove her fingers together and pulled them apart with quick, awkward motions. Ajax glanced at Roach and grinned wickedly.
Maybe Fresh Meat here thinks she should get a chance. The prisoner ran her planet after all.
Ajax had joined Twilight after the obliteration of the Rebellion's 32nd Infantry. He'd been one of five survivors among 400 dead, and he still proudly wore the 32nd's Bleeding Roughnecks badge. He was a jerk and a grenadier with better aim than most snipers. Namir found him tolerable in small doses. Roach kept looking at her fingers. Gadrin spoke to Ajax but watched the girl.
The Fresh Meat knows she's not alone. We all have scars, and we endure them together.
Roach squeezed her hands together until pink skin turned white. Finally, she met Gadrin's gaze.
You got scars? She asked.
Twitch played a card that made the rest of the table wince. Gadrin kept speaking as he reshuffled the deck. His voice was calm, easy, as if he'd answered the question 1,000 times before.
The Empire took my kin and sold them as slaves to a Hutt clan.
Roach cursed softly. Brand looked down at her cards as if avoiding intruding on a private moment.
If I had not found Twilight Company,
Gadrin said and shrugged,
I would have died long ago. Sharing grief and grievances does us good when we face an enemy of such ebon depths. The Empire is a force unprecedented in any age, poised to end history itself. No one should confront it alone.
Ajax glanced at the pot, tossed in a credit chip, and smirked.
Shortest story I've ever heard a Besalisk tell. Good on you, Gadrin.
Namir's instinct was to toss his data pad at Ajax, but he was only halfway through his inventory. Instead, he called without looking up.
First, don't be obnoxious. Second, he's Corellian, not Besalisk. Insult him right.
Ajax cackled. Namir didn't understand why until he saw Gadrin smiling too. Even Roach and Brand seemed to be holding back snickers. Twitch didn't look away from her cards.
Corellia is a human world,
Gadrin said patiently.
And I live there a long time. I consider it my home, but my species is Besalisk.
Ajax slapped his right hand on top of Roach's left.
The sergeant there,
he said to Roach in a mock whisper.
He ain't cultured and educated like us.
Namir swore at Ajax in a cool, stilted tone. The others laughed, and Namir tried to let the moment of humiliation glide over him. Dwelling on it would only make it worse. The card players picked up the game again. Twitch won the next round to no one's surprise. Roach seemed to be struggling with something, looking between Gadrin and the others, parting her lips now and then as if she wanted to speak. Of the players, only Brand seemed to notice, but she kept her usual silence.
6 months, Roach finally said, in an imp detention center.
The others looked at her perplexed. She hunched her shoulders and shrugged.
My grudge, she explained.
Gadrin gruffly clapped Roach on the back. Twitch raised an eyebrow inquisitively, but didn't press Roach for the details. Ajax grinned.
Guess it's story time.
He took the deck of cards from Gadrin and began to deal.
Winner this round picks who goes next.
Namir watched Ajax closely, but he couldn't tell if the man was cheating or not. All he was sure of was that 2 minutes later, Ajax winked when he claimed his victory and pointed at Brand. Brand took it in stride.
I'm not here for a grudge, she said.
Ajax pressed her.
So why are you?
I took a bounty on the captain, Brand said.
Gadrin shook his head. Namir knew he'd heard that much of the story before. The others were suddenly focused on Brand.
What happened? Roach asked. I changed my mind, Brand said. Your story, Ajax.
Ajax was keen to share, and Namir decided to make his exit while the others were occupied. He didn't need to hear about Ajax and his lovers and their hunting trip again, and he didn't want to be around when his turn to speak came. He wasn't in the mood to argue, and he wasn't in the mood to lie. He ascended the ladder through the tight shaft leading to the aft end of the crew deck. He paused at the top, closed his eyes, and leaned against the gentle curve of the wall. He was glad Roach was finding a place in the company. He was glad Governor Chalice was a distraction from rumors of imminent doom. But he needed a break of his own, or he needed to get back to the fight. Halfway to the barracks, Namir realized that Brand was walking beside him. He wasn't sure how long she'd been there or where she'd caught up. He couldn't even pinpoint the moment he'd noticed her company. She had eased into Namir's consciousness like stars emerging at night. When Namir looked directly at his companion, Brand spoke in an easy tone as if they'd been talking for hours.
How do you think they'll hold up?
Namir struggled to make sense of the words. The new recruits? Brand nodded. Roach is trying. The others don't know jack about squad combat, but they can't shoot and take orders. We've seen worse.
You give them the meat grinder speech?
Figured it wasn't the time. They saw us on Haydoral. They're not under any illusions this life is glamorous. The corner of Brand's mouth twitched.
Doesn't mean they know a high command sends us into hell every time.
Howl sends us into hell.
Howl keeps us alive.
That too. Brand snorted.
You ever think you're too hard on him?
Namir glanced down the corridor. There was a lot about a Howl he didn't want to be heard saying, particularly by the recruits. Howl's a genius, he said. You won that argument on Black Tarsist. Just wish he wasn't mad as a Glimmerstim addict reading omens in his filth. They walked together in silence until the door to Namir's barracks came into view. You know it's going to get worse, Brand said.
With her on board.
Roach? Namir asked.
Don't be stupid.
Namir studied Brand's face, tried to read her expression. As ever, she was closed to him. You know something? About what the captain's up to with Chalice? Brand turned and began to walk away before she even answered.
I don't know anything, she said.
But sometimes, I guess lucky.
Ah!
The attack came 3 days later in the middle of the night shift. The ship's klaxon brought Namir out of his bunk with a groan of exhaustion and frustration, but he had his shirt and boots on in under 30 seconds. His bunkmates were scrambling to dress as well. Roja asked Namir if he knew what was going on. "You're kidding," was Namir's only answer. He was too tired for anything else. The first rumble and the subsequent echo of rending metal made it obvious that the Thunderstrike had entered combat. The ship's corridors were full of Twilight soldiers rushing to shelter while the crew took to battle stations. Unless the enemy sent a boarding party, infantry had no place in a clash of starships, and the best Twilight's ground troops could do was stay out of the way and keep their distance from the hull. Meanwhile, the bridge crew, engineering, and the gunnery staff, along with the pilot on his promise, if the gunship hadn't been destroyed in a surprise attack, would try to keep everyone alive. Namir recognized the energy and purpose in the crew members and despised them with every step they took. They weren't to blame, but there was nothing worse than feeling useless and stupid during a fight. Namir's assigned shelter was the mess hall. Twilight soldiers were pressed tight against one another when he arrived. The room stank of sweat. Someone called his name and waved from near the entrance. Sergeant Fectrin, one hand cupped over an ear and the other fiddling with his comlink. Namir pushed his way through. Fectrin finished speaking into the comm as the ship rumbled again.
"All shelters report in. Head count is a few short, but we assume it's just stragglers.
Take their names when they show up. Report any fresh meat to me," Namir replied. "Any idea who's attacking?"
"Something bigger than a pirate, smaller than a Star Destroyer."
The deck lurched, and several soldiers toppled into their piers. Namir kept his balance as Fectrin cupped his ear again before growling,
"Section 10! Might be a hull breach!"
Namir swore reflexively. So much damage so fast was never a good sign. But Section 10 was low risk. Not much there except... He swore again. "What about the brig? Is it intact?" Fectrin looked confused, then winced as he was struck by comprehension.
"Nothing from the guard, but that could mean comm trouble or..."
Namir was already heading out of the mess. He knew that in all likelihood the prisoner was secure in the airlock. Maybe she'd already been relocated. But he'd found an excuse to do something other than wait, and he'd taken it. As he approached Section 10, Namir reached a blast door in the corridor. Someone had sealed off the hall. He checked the panel readings, saw there was still life support beyond the barricade, and decided to chance it. The airlock wasn't more than 50 meters out. How bad could it be? Namir tapped in a coat and felt an expulsion of heat break against his face as the door irised open. The corridor howled like a storm. Orange flame raged out of air vents and severed pipes, splashing into the wall and causing metal panels to warp and shriek. Namir stumbled back a step, then fell to his knees when the ship shook. He swore again and wished he'd brought his helmet. He pulled his shirt up to half shield his face and wrapped his hands in the ends of his sleeves. The fabric was, in theory, fire resistant. In the field, he'd seen combat outfits fused to men and women's skin before it caught flame. Not strictly comforting, but proof of durability. He paused long enough to wonder about the fire's temperature. Was it fueled by chemicals from the pipelines? But shrugged away the question. He didn't have the expertise to apply the answer if he'd had one. Namir resisted the urge to charge forward. He couldn't afford to stumble or fall if the ship took another hit. Instead, he set a deliberate pace, knees bent for balance and to keep his body small. The heat was searing, but soon the pain seemed to plateau. Agony ravaged his skin, and it neither grew worse nor faded. He felt no different when he pushed through a curtain of flame than when he left it behind. Then he was at the airlock. The door was sealed. At the base, lying flat, as if she'd been slammed unconscious against the door by one of the ship's upheavals, was the on-duty guard. Namir couldn't tell whether the woman was still breathing, but the flames hadn't reached her. A glance through the airlock's view panel revealed that the governor was still inside, sitting cross-legged at the far end of the room. Suddenly, Namir laughed. He had no idea whether he was authorized to open the airlock, whether his codes would open the door. He might burn to death for nothing. At least he wasn't waiting in the mess hall. He pulled his shirt back into place and punched his access code into the lock. The door mechanisms groaned and stirred. "Guess the captain has some faith in me," he thought. The airlock interior was furnished with everything the stores of the Thunderstrike had to offer. Though that amounted to little more than a trunk, a cot, a stained food tray, and a portable sanitation station. Several data pads were stacked on the cot, and in front of the cross-legged governor hovered a miniature holodroid, projecting a shimmering blue web of spheres and lines. Chalice's hands played across the image, extending and rotating the lines, reshaping the web with expert precision. Chalice was standing, and the web was gone by the time the door was fully open. "I see you chose not to let me suffocate," she said. Namir knelt and checked the guard's body as cooler air flooded in from the airlock. Still alive. He recognized her face but couldn't recall her name. One of the recruits Twilight had picked up on Thessian. He slid his hands under the woman's arms and half-lifted her from the floor. He wanted to scream at the abrasions on his burnt hands. Instead, he gritted his teeth and managed to ask, "You really think suffocation was your worst problem?" Chalice smiled and stalked forward, then stopped with a wince as she felt the heat of the corridor. Namir felt grim satisfaction at the sight of the governor taken aback. "Air circulation isn't functioning," Chalice said, "so yes, that was my priority. Until you opened the door, I was safe from the fire." Namir grunted and dragged the guard into the airlock while Chalice eyed the doorway. "Can we run for it?" she asked. Her voice had dropped an octave, all mockery gone. "I could, maybe." Namir lowered the guard to the floor. He tried to catch his breath while ignoring the pain clinging to his skin like mud. "But I'm dressed for it. You'd roast alive." Chalice closed her eyes and lowered her head. Then her neck snapped back up and she looked at Namir. "So we open the airlock's outer door. We create a vacuum. We cling to the walls for dear life. And when the oxygen has rushed out and the fires in the section have been extinguished, we close the door and get to safety." It took Namir a moment to process the suggestion. Then he laughed hoarsely as he stepped back into the doorframe. "You've got it all figured." He edged far enough into the corridor to hit the control panel again, then ducked back into the airlock. The interior door began to hum shut. Chalice stared, and her tone became harsh. "What are you doing?" Namir gestured at the guard with the toe of his boot as the door sealed with a metallic clang. "We opened this section up to space. She's not in any shape to hold on." Chalice's expression seemed to contort. Namir was sure she was going to shout, to rage. He wondered if he'd need to fight her off. Instead, she simply said in a voice of dull resignation, "So you're locking us in." "I'm locking us in," Namir agreed, "and hoping for the best." Namir had trouble tracking time inside the airlock. The oxygen felt abrasive against his burnt skin. His head was throbbing, echoing every beat of his heart inside his skull. He tried counting the number of hits the Thunderstrike took in battle, but even that became difficult when he could no longer differentiate a new strike from the aftershocks of an old one. Chayla sat across from him. "This is the second time you've come to rescue me, you know," she said. "Be grateful," Namir said, "and shut up. You haven't earned any favors," Chalice countered evenly. "The first time you thought I was someone else. Then you shot me. This time, I'm no better off than I was before you showed. I'm worse off, in fact, since all three of us are using what's left of the air." She didn't give the unconscious guard so much as a glance. Namir exhaled in a hiss. The air was getting thinner, and it smelled of smoke. He was prepared to stare down Chalice if he had to, though, to ignore his cloudy vision and to try to put her in her place by force of will. As he squared his shoulder, she smiled sourly, like a woman taken with her own dark humor. Not a woman worth saving. Yet not a woman who appeared to fear death either. Namir watched the guard's chest slowly rise and fall. You may not be better off. She is, he said. The governor shrugged as if she didn't see the statement's relevance. Namir closed his eyes and leaned against the bulkhead. Any idea who attacked us? You're the expert. A distant rumble from below accompanied a jolt through the deck. Namir bounced an arm's width off the floor and couldn't quite stifle a gasp when he landed hard on his tailbone. Chalice didn't cry out, and Namir didn't bother opening his eyes to check on her. She waited until the ship settled before answering. At a guess, she said, a hint of strain in her voice. I'd say my former colleagues are coming after me. Can't have Imperial secrets falling into rebel hands. Can't have another SIBO or a Death Star incident. By now, Darth Vader himself should be in pursuit. Whether that's his flagship out there, I can't be sure. If not, we may be spared so he can kill me personally. Namir snorted. What is it with you people and Vader? It can't be the helmet that scares people. Stormtroopers have helmets. When Chalice replied, her voice held the note of curiosity. Most rebels blanch when they hear the name. He may be mythologized, but he's earned his reputation. I could tell tales of how he slaughtered children. The Denmo genocides. Spare me, Namir said. That's my dying wish. Spare me the stories of the great Lord Vader's terrifying triumphs over the rebellion. After he spoke, he wished he hadn't added such a sneer to the word rebellion. He cracked his eyes open enough to confirm that the guard was still unconscious. Chalice was watching him closely. You don't think of yourself as one of them, do you? She asked. Namir closed his eyes again and made an obscene gesture in Chalice's direction.
He'd learned it from Twilight's dead comtech long ago, and he wasn't sure how commonplace it was.
From Chalice's laughter, however, she seemed to get the point. Neither spoke for a while, and eventually Namir realized that the shuddering of the deck had ceased. The battle apparently was over. Even better, the pain of Namir's burns had decreased to a steady but subtle throbbing. It probably meant he'd gone into shock, but he wasn't in any shape to worry. Namir knew he was drifting in and out of consciousness, and he ceased to fight the pull of darkness when he heard the hiss of air vents coming back to life. His last thought was about the guard, the new recruit from Thessian. Her name was Maediu. She never listened during training. Namir hoped she would survive. During his tour with Twilight Company, Namir had spent more than a few days in Thunderstrike's infirmary. He'd broken bones, taken blaster shots, and seen shrapnel lodged in his flesh. In his experience, Twilight's medics offered two types of recuperation. The first involved a blissful state of oblivion and submersion in a tank of liquid bacta. The tank was a sanctuary from pain and need, a welcoming home for as many hours or days as the medics deemed necessary, or in less ideal circumstances, until bacta supplies ran low. The patient floated in pure, viscous health, emerging from unconsciousness gradually until full awareness was restored. The aches that came in the days following always felt worse for the loss of the bacta's pleasures, but they passed soon enough. The second type of recuperation involved lying on a hard bunk, stinking of cleaning fluid and shivering in too cold air while slipping in and out of sleep. During moments of near lucidity, the patient was afflicted with visions of blood-soaked med staff making their rounds, alternating stinging shots with numbing bombs. During sleep, the patient suffered confused fever dreams without narrative or logic. Endless streams of images, of faces strange and familiar, along with inexplicable feelings of terror and alienation. as if the dreamer were alone in a world where every once familiar object hid horrors. Namir's recuperation from his burns took the second form. Hours after he'd been rushed to the medbay, during one miserable moment of clarity, he saw that May Diyu had been placed in a Bacta tank. Lucky girl, he thought. He was back on his feet within 2 days, his arms scarred and tender, but his body largely restored. Von Geis warned him not to return to full duty for another few shifts. A suggestion Namir was willing enough to take, given that Twilight's next combat assignment was nowhere in sight. The attack on the Thunderstrike had apparently been a fluke. A chance run-in with an Imperial reconnaissance squadron, resulting in the deaths of 3 crew members aboard a Pylonus Promise, 6 injuries aboard Thunderstrike, and minor systems damage to both ships. There was no evidence that the Imperials had been hunting Governor Chalice, who had been found unscathed in the airlock with Namir and Maediu. The woman led a charmed life. A day after Namir's release from the infirmary, after he'd read the latest reports and screwed up his courage, he arranged a meeting with Howell. He found the captain in the workroom off the operations center, pacing between upright displays and a holotape that projected topographic images of a world dense with waterways and jungles. Howell was speaking softly to himself, one hand tapping at the air as if beating out a rhythm to his words. Captain Micah Evon was a tall man, with dark brown skin and graying hair that seemed to tangle in his thick beard. Namir knew little of his past and had trouble imagining him existing prior to Twilight. He had founded the company, so Namir had been told, and it seemed impossible that he would ever leave. He rarely emerged from his lair, going unseen by the rank and file for days at a time while his senior staff passed down orders. Namir believed with utter certainty that Howling Mad Evon was the greatest mind he'd ever fought with. He also believed Hal was responsible for the deaths of dozens of his friends, deaths that might have been avoided, and that the captain would sacrifice Namir in an eye blink to win some esoteric victory for the Rebel Alliance. Howell laughed at something while Namir stood inside the doorway, waiting to be recognized. When the captain finally waved him closer, he looked Namir up and down with an almost fierce intensity.
"Sergeant," he said, "what have you heard about Mount Arakirkos?"
"I'm not familiar with it," Namir said, as Hal gestured distractedly at a chair. Namir walked to it but didn't seat himself.
"Neither am I," Hal said. "But at the top, there's a great clock set in stone, built by the Arakeen monks almost 2,000 standard years ago. According to legend, whoever watches each swing of its pendulum for a day will have the lifespan of the universe revealed before his eyes."
He resumed his pacing as he spoke, punctuating his words with small gestures and finally looking back to Namir. Namir shook his head. "I'll take your word for it. Religious orders aren't my thing." Private conversations with Hal were like exhuming a corpse. You had to dig and dig before you found what you were looking for, and even then, it wouldn't be pretty. But Namir had learned that there was no rushing the captain when he had his own topic in mind.
"Time isn't just the provenance of philosophers," Hal said, as if correcting a child's mistake. "We live on a ship powered by energies that sunder cause and effect, beginning and end. Hyperspace is a mystery more profound than gods and demons."
Hal dropped into a chair across from Namir, spread his hands and bowed his head.
"Yet we use it to make war," he said. "And here we are.
Tell me what's on your mind."
"Governor Chalice,"
Namir said.
"Were we attacked because of her?"
The last of Hal's effervescence vanished as if incinerated in a flash fire.
"We don't know. Chalice certainly thinks so. But she's not an unbiased source.
The more she convinces us the Imperials value her, the more she can demand for her help."
"I get that," Namir said.
"But you've talked to her.
Do you think she's for real?"
"She could be."
"Because if she is,"
Namir pressed on, He was sure he was overstepping. He was first sergeant, not the captain strategist or second in command. He was in Twilight to execute orders, not question them. Twilight has a target on its back. A lot worse could come.
Vader,
Howl said.
Chayla said it to me too.
Namir shrugged. Vader or Captain Dirtfarm, doesn't matter who comes if they're backed by an armada. The best thing for us is to get rid of her. Howl shook his head and tapped a long, slow rhythm onto the hollow table.
I can't, he said. We found her and she's our responsibility.
Turn her over to another company. Someone in the rebellion must be equipped for this.
Equipped for what?
Howl asked, without a trace of impatience.
We don't even know what we have. And we're still 10,000 light-years deep in Imperial territory and struggling to get to safety. No one nearby can watch her or protect her any better than we can, and I'm not prepared to take more dramatic action.
Namir watched his captain. He didn't doubt Hal was capable of lying to him. Good commanders often lie to their troops. Yet his arguments had the ring of truth. They simply weren't complete.
You think it's a trap?
Namir said. It was a guess.
She's a double agent, or she's being manipulated.
It's a possibility,
Hal said.
You think you have a way to find out?
Namir said. Hal smiled, but he didn't answer. He stood and paced a few steps, stared at the door to the workroom, then held up a hand as if calling for silence.
The Rebel Alliance, he said, is falling apart. Things are as bad as they've been since, well, since long before you came aboard. And if the Empire wins, it wins completely. We need an edge. And we might have found one. I'm going to test that edge. If it cuts, I'm going to hone it. We're already taking the first steps. Chayla's promised to assemble a schematic, a holographic map of the Empire's entire logistical network, showing its strengths and vulnerabilities. If she can do that, it will change the war. But we need to see if we can rely on her first.
Namir nodded slowly.
So what's our next mission?
He asked.
What did she tell you when you first met?
Hal didn't reply. He merely opened the workroom door to the corridor and smiled again, sadly, at Namir. Their meeting was over.